Well, Andrew Plimpton was president of the Saints from 1993 through until the year 2000. A heck of a lot happened during that period. Multiple coaches, a pre-season premiership, an AFL grand final in 1997, a move from Waverley Park to the Docklands. Technically, obviously, the start of the move from Moorabbin to Waverley, which happened between 92 and 93. Obviously, the passing of a club legend in there as well in Trevor Barker. There was a heck of a lot to work through. The AFL was working on mergers, and our name had been thrown up a couple of times during that period. But here we are. And Andrew, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure, Darren. Yes, a lot happened in 9 years.
What I wanted to start with, we had Ross Oakley on a few weeks ago, obviously talking about his hard luck stories through the 60s. But also we asked him the question as to how perilous it got for St Kilda during that period when there was the Hawthorn and Melbourne talk and the eventual Fitzroy merger. He said we were never as close as a lot of other clubs. Is that an accurate reflection? Were we always relatively comfortable despite what happened in the mid-90s with the Save Our Saints?
Yeah, I mean, I had a discussion. I had a discussion with a number of clubs, and perhaps the one I got closest to on behalf of the club was the Carlton Football Club. So people didn't think that I'd do it, but, you know, in a sense that it was a position that we didn't talk about football colours, position on the ladder or number of premierships. It was, you know, a likely fit if we were to go down that down that path. So I spent all, you know, a good deal of time with John Elliott and with the Blues, and interesting times.
Andrew, I guess going back to the very start, but you're a football nut. You're well known to love the game of football. How did you end up at the footy club?
Okay, so I loved the Saints as a young guy. I lived in Brighton, so I used to go in my very youngish days to the Fitzroy Street ground and saw the emergence of Dittrich, etc., like that. So I started off as a strong supporter of the club. And I joined the Halos at a fairly young age, and then they asked me to become chairman of the marketing committee for the club. Back in those days, Nick, there was both the football club and the social club. So there was two different corporations, two different entities, some would argue very much at war with each other during various times of the career. So I sat between both of them. And then when we did the deal, which I wasn't part of, I wasn't on the board, to sign up to move to Waverley, there was a high level of discontent within the membership of the club. There was a huge faction of the club that didn't want to leave Moorabbin and go to Waverley. So the board had a few issues with various pressure groups. So they asked me to intervene and become, if you like, the conduit to the within the social club and the football club and these groups. So there was a group called Keep the Saints at St Kilda. And I should use one name who's well known in St Kilda circles, who was very much involved with that, called Bruce Eaver. So there was a group of active people. They were determined, but they were also they were polite. They thought things through. So that was 6 or 7 months of going through that. And from that, and when we finally got the vote to move to Waverley, the club asked me whether I'd be interested in becoming the president of the club. So I spent a very small amount of time on the board and became president pretty quickly, soon after that.
When you first came into the club, was there any ideas that you might have brought up that you say, oh, this is sort of what I can see could be something that could work for the club, or this is not working for the club, or anything that you tried to implement or that may not have happened that you thought might have been a good idea?
Yeah, look, I went with very much, you know, with an open mind. I, you know, lived as we all have at St Kilda, lived with, you know, the one premiership saga all our lives and all the baggage that goes with that. And I could just add, look, I've been very fortunate since St Kilda. You know, I was in charge of Olympic sailing for three Olympic Games, you know, with number one in the world, number two medal team in Australia next to swimming. And I've also been involved with the Institute of Sport for 10 years as a member and director of the Institute of Sport in Canberra. So, you know, in that sense, I've had 30 years' experience now in high-performance sport. One of the issues, I guess, that I saw from coming on board school, I always thought that Moorabbin as much as an emotional, lovely place was a millstone around our neck. And, you know, one thing I did was some research in history of why St Kilda, one of the reasons why St Kilda was unsuccessful. And people seem to, I won't say forget, but not give enough credence to the fact that we had spent so much time and energy and planning of moving out of Fitzroy Street to Moorabbin. We spent all our spare cash on building stadiums, the Graham Huggard Stand and all the rest of it. But we missed that era in football of where footballers were being transferred on form fours, et cetera, like that. And we just didn't have the cash to compete. And, you know, when you consistently don't have cash to compete in the marketplace, you get yourselves behind the eight ball. And that's exactly what we did. And, of course, in those days when you were trying to attract players from Adelaide, Western Australia, Tassie, et cetera, and you didn't have either form or the likelihood of form, you know, going into the 70s where we expanded into Moorabbin, it was just a difficult time for the club. And I think one of the things is not blaming people. People did a great job in keeping the club alive, but it was just a very difficult time. We were financially behind the eight ball.
Can you take us through how you negotiated through some of the challenges in the first 2 years? So obviously, 93, we're at a new home. The form unfortunately dropped off a little bit. We had the Nicky Windmar situation with his manager where he left for a while. And then obviously a coaching change at the end of that year with Sheldon going out, Elves coming in. And then 12 months later, you lose Tony Lockett.
Yeah, well, I think you know, in that sort of order, the Windmar situation, I was very much involved with of recovering Nick back to the club. There was all sorts of issues of lack of trust, etc. So, Windmar and I regard ourselves as good, you know, very much good friends, and I did a lot of work on a one for one basis to help bring you know, Cuz back into the club, which successfully happened. Change of coaches was a difficult time. I had just joined as president. I was a recruit president in that sense and had to, as I should have, listened to a lot of people. And it was a view to open up the open up the coaching responsibilities. The Lockett matter was an interesting one, is that, look, I could spend an hour or so talking about that. In summary, Tony was made a outrageously good offer from the Sydney Swans. And in the end, we wished Tony the best. We got draft picks for him. And if we look at how this club rebuilt itself in 94, 95, was very much with 17 young kids on the list. And the work we did was to get where we got to in 97, 98.
Andrew, we probably don't have an hour to talk about the Lockett situation, but could you give us a little bit more detail into how that unfolded? Because I think a lot of the footy world, I guess, assumed that he would be going to a Collingwood or a Richmond that had been fairly public in their pursuit of players. Yes. And then all of a sudden he ends up at Sydney. How did those negotiations unfold? And I guess, how did that trade happen?
Okay. So you're absolutely got it correct. History is right. Richmond were chasing him hard, as were the Collingwood Football Club. We had a position of he was an uncontracted player, and the other highlight act in that draft was Paul Roos. So there was two of them that were vying for, if you like, equal top billing of potential money. So Collingwood made every effort they could to negotiate with us at St Kilda, as did the Richmond Football Club. In the end, Sydney offered us the best opportunity of draft choices, and to Sydney's credit, they offered Tony an absolutely fantastic deal. And all through this process, credit to Tony, was that he had always taken the view, ahead of his manager, of saying, I want to do the best for the St Kilda Footy Club. And the best draft choices and the best opportunities came from the Swans, as well as the best package that they provided for Tony. So in that sense, he was an uncontracted player. He could have left us in the lurch and just gone and made decisions, but he worked alongside us as we worked with the Swans to get the best possible deal for him. He did for himself, and get the best possible deal for the Saints. So out of that, we got four draft choices, and it enabled negotiations to take place. As I said, you know, over that sort of two-year period, we recruited an enormous amount of players: Smith, Brown, Jones, Lappin. We got Darryl Wakeland out of the plug at Deal. So, you know, I and go on with that list later on, Andrew Thompson, Max Hudson, et cetera, like that, Barry Hall. So we got the core of a group of players, Peter Everett, that supported this club for 10, 15 years, either playing for this club or other coaches using them as draft bait to go and trade up. So it was a fantastic group of players that we brought through the club.
Sam, we think about those players that came in and the list we started building through 95, we started showing a bit of promise. Then started 96, we end up and go and win the ANZAC Cup as it was at the time. Do you think the win in that ANZAC Cup was actually a good thing for the club? Do you think it gave us, I guess, more confidence, or do you think maybe that might have given us a bit of overconfidence, like in going into the season, because we know we didn't travel too well that year afterwards?
Yeah, look, it was a mixed year. Interesting, Aaron, because I had many discussions with Stan about this after we'd won it. How hard, you know, the question was for us, how hard were we going to go for it? And was it important to us? Was it important for the club? Two reasons it was important. One, to give a lot of young guys the ability of playing together, which certainly evolved. The other thing it gave us was we had to win four games in a row to get there. And one of the disciplines of football is consistently winning footy games, which perhaps our club might want to reflect on at the moment. But it just gave us a sense of purpose of winning four games in a row. Later on in the season, we got chewed out in many games. I remember one big one against North Melbourne. And the answer in 95, if you look at the profile, the strength and conditioning of many of our younger players, Jones, Smith, Brown, we just weren't physically able to match clubs like then Essendon and then North Melbourne. But we quickly grew when the players got 20 to 30 games under their belt, developed physically. So 96 was a sort of year of coming together. We weren't quite strong enough to compete at the top end.
Two-part question on 97. So obviously it started poorly. How close did it come to reaching an end point for Stan in about round five? And then I read an interesting article a few years ago about the build-up to the grand final, how I think you were still in the office at 10 o'clock the night before taking calls from other presidents, John Elliott, Richard Collis, offering you tickets, offering you advice on what to do and all of that sort of thing. Can you take us through the Stan evolution that year and then how you handled grand final week? It would have been obviously quite unique.
Yeah. So firstly with Stan, there was somebody had started a story in the press, and it wasn't ourselves. We had Stan under no pressure. But I do remember the game. Memories. We played Brisbane, I think around six. It was a hot day, 30 degrees in Brisbane, and we lost the game. And we should never have lost the game. I remember walking across the Oval and getting a mobile phone call from one of the journos from The Age saying, I believe Stan Alves is about to be fired, which was news to me and news to Jerry Reimer, vice president, and other board members. Anyway, it sort of got a little bit of momentum. So I had to hold meetings all during that week. And my response to the media was, you know, it's not Stan under the pressure. The whole club's under pressure. You know, we expected to be doing something special in 97, and we weren't. So thankfully, we turned the pressure off Stan. He took the pressure off himself. Certainly straightened a lot of things out within the club structure and of how we're going to approach games. And after that, we sort of clicked and came together. So there was no pressure from the board on Stan. There was pressure within the football department, within the playing group and all the other coaches of how we were managing ourselves. So it was an internal pressure, and we were not doing well. We managed to sort ourselves out though. Grand final week. You guys are great saints like myself. So one thing I remember doing is started really on the Monday night, and you know, I sat next to the table in the back of the boy Harvey, who won that Brownlow medal. So you know, one thing that we all promised each other, I think everyone was you know, looking to say, oh look, the Saints are going to get ahead of themselves, they're all going to get out on the booze, you know, that's the officials, people like myself. So I spent a week of not drinking, sitting there just enjoying the company. You know, the Carbine Club was on Tuesday, but it was all very serious stuff. I tried not to be what I can be, and that is having a drink and enjoying myself. So it was a very disciplined week for everybody within the club, and it was a busy week for us. But you know, with Harves winning the Brownlow on the Monday, all the other events that take place, it was a, you know, a week to remember, except for the Saturday.
Andrew, we've spoken to a number of the players that were out there that day on the Saturday and about their disappointment, how they had to rebound, I guess, physically, mentally, emotionally. Obviously, there's Joel Smith during the year, does his knee and doesn't come back. A number of other players, Nicky Winmar leaves the club not long after, you know, that 97-98 period. But from a business perspective, a club perspective, how do you rebound, I guess, as an executive, as a board, as a football club, from that disappointment, especially with all that expectation and the pressure on the club from, you know, from fans, from sponsors, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah. So, Nick, I think one thing we were expecting, and that was because we'd only won one premiership in our life, and people would gloss over the importance, the critical importance of losing Spider, All Australian ruckman. And, you know, to me, it was as important to us as Max Gorn is to the Melbourne Football Club, you know, not only for his rucking ability to go forward and kick in goals. So Spider was just in brilliant form and he was so important to us. And then losing Lazar, Bitterbeck. I mean, you know, Lazar was a workhorse for us in the ruck. So to lose them, as you said, Nick, to lose Smith, our forward flanker, and when we played Collingwood round 18 or whatever it was, and then to have, you know, the misfortune of Nicky losing his dad, dying on the Thursday, et cetera, like that, it was a tough time for all of us. And I think we all understood that we were going to be somewhat vilified by many in the media, you know, for being another failure, can't get to success. You know, when you look at our odds and look at our performance in that preliminary final, one would normally have expected us, even notwithstanding some of those injuries, probably to make a real fist of it, which at halftime we're 14 points up, and as you know, Nick, we lost the game. So it was tough. It was tough on the club. I think one of the things we did from a business point of view was that we sort of set ourselves some targets at everything we did. We had to have a measurement for results, and that is across the club, you know, marketing had to increase by 5%. We had a 5% rule on everything we did. You know, improvement in players' fitness. So everything we measured was in incremental by degrees. So the old adage, you know, Kevin Chidi has extolled this over the years that, you know, if you don't do anything, you don't improve, you stand still, you're going to effectively going backwards in AFL footy. So we put a real test of it on ourselves of incrementally measuring everything that we did from the club, both in the office, in the marketing and sales, and also player performance. And you know what? We got there. And we started off 98, you know, winning games, not by huge margins, but by winning. I think you guys can probably quote me, you know, by around 12, 13, we were first or second on the ladder. So we're up there again. And then things at the back end of the season fell apart. And it was unfortunate. We put too much pressure on ourselves. And you know what? Stan had put a lot more unwieldy pressure on the whole of the football department. It was not a good, comfortable scene to be in at the back end of the season. We just went too hard on too many things and just didn't bring enough people along with us on a really tough ride.
Now, one of the business parts of the club that came up towards the end of your tenure was the move to the Docklands. How did you view the deal we were getting when we were going to Docklands? There's been like a number of people saying we copped a bit of the bad end of the pineapple, I guess, on with the deal. But how did you view it when you first got to see it?
Yeah. So, Aaron, it's got to be looked at in many, many parts, is that we employed pro bono Boston Consulting to do all the comparisons on every offer that we had. We had offers from the MCG and we had the offer from Etihad. So that was all measured out. What people, I won't say tend to forget about, but because you're asking a good question here, one of the things that we managed to get was guarantees from the AFL on our 97 grand final year. Guarantee on gate receipts, guarantee on marketing, guarantee on outdoor advertising, et cetera, like that. So when ultimately I handed the club to the president, Rod Butters, as I said, You know, there's a lot of things you don't have to concern yourself about. You will, but you're guaranteed income for 5 years on a lot of business lines here. So in that sense, the club had some comfort that financially it knew where its position was. Reserve seating was another thing. The AFL, through Ross Oakley, also bought additional sponsorship. I mean, we regained Carlton United Breweries as a sponsor after the Tui's deal was off, and I think that was an extra $500,000 a year. So as much as people can paint a bad picture, for us, it was a pretty good picture. And I guess that we all have to sort of remember as well, at the end of the day, there was an AFL commission that tells you where to go. And by this stage, I knew a lot of commissioners and I knew the view of the AFL. And the AFL view was, you're going to the Docklands, boys. So we had to make a great deal out of it. And look, things didn't quite work out the way. The game didn't open up. The ground didn't open up in under great circumstances. But, you know, we've done okay. We've done okay. We're surviving. We're doing okay there.
You mentioned the environment, I guess, around the back end of 98 and the pressure that was on the club, on Stan, from Stan, etc. How did, I guess, from your perspective, what was that like, that period of, you know, 10 or 15 weeks through the back end of 98 leading into 99? And how did the end of Stan Alves' tenure at the club come about?
Well, I think, I want to be a little cautious because I want to be very respectful of Stan and the work that he did. But I can just say, Nick, we had a complete breakdown within the club of communication and ability to get along with each other. And there was just, a breakdown between assistant coaches, chairman of selectors, the head coach, people in the football department, and indeed this rubs off on footballers. So if one looks and analyzes why we lost those, you know, because we fell into the finals indeed with a second chance. But if we look at the loss of those games at the very back end of the season with no injuries, somebody's got a question is how does a club that played in the grand final last year, started the year off and did so well, end up losing those block of games? And there was just a complete, absolutely moribund club in regards to wanting to get on together, do things together. And I'm not apportioning blame at the head coach, but, you know, obviously the head coach has got to take responsibilities and therefore a decision was made for us and Stan to depart. Again, let me just repeat, for all the other things, getting us to the grand final, et cetera, like that, one never wants to lose sight of giving Stan an enormous praise. And you know what? I don't have deep conversations with Stan about it, but I respect Stan. I caught up with him a couple of weeks ago at the Team of the Decade, and I don't want to in any ways, you know, decry his performance over the years, but it was a tough couple of months for the footy club.
It's nice to hear that, I guess, because you hear whispers about, you know, the senior, you know, Stan lost the senior players, and there's all these stories that kind of float around, and yeah, you know, nobody ever really wants to talk about. So it's nice to hear that you still have a decent enough relationship with Stan, and it was nice to see him there at that function the other week as well.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, I suppose the hardest thing to do is when you've professionally led a team like Stan has, is that when you look back and you're retrospective about it and you admit to, you know, significant errors being made along the tour, and Stan made a speech at that luncheon, and, you know, he wasn't apologetic in a sense, but he was mindful of all the things that happened at the, you know, St Kilda Football Club in his last year of coaching.
Last one for me, I guess a two-parter. So do you feel that some of that tension kind of lingered on in the sense that obviously we fell away a bit 99-2000, but after you left, obviously that tumultuous 2001 where Butters and Co get Malcolm Blight that last half of season, he's gone, Grant Thomas comes in. Were you sort of sitting there on the outer thinking, bloody hell, what's going on there? And how do you feel now, obviously 20 years down the track, we've obviously played finals a bit. We're sort of on the way back now after some lean periods, but the club got very close to winning that flag that you nearly won.
Yeah. So, look, I was always interested in where Rod was going to take the club. I put him on the board. I was pleased to, you know, to see he wanted to become involved, and I've, you know, I have become good friends of Rod Butters. So I can say this about Rod. The first 2 years I thought of his presidency was just not that good. You know, he was sort of everywhere and the back end of his coaching of his presidency, I thought was fantastic. He was enigmatic. You know, he was always looking to do deals. He did a fantastic job. The question is, the Blight case was an interesting one, and I'm not so sure Malcolm Blight, in retrospect, really wanted to coach, but he was talked into coaching. It was a great opportunity for him to earn a sizable amount of money. And I think the board did the absolute right thing with discontinuing with Malcolm. I think, then because he behind the scenes, Thomas came involved, and Thomas, you know, managed to weave some magic and also cause a lot of, some other tensions within the club. So it's been an interesting ride.
The other, I guess, big decision that we made towards the end of your tenure as well was we decided to give a newsreader the head coach position. What was it that Tim Watson brought to the table that sort of put him above other candidates that we had at the time? What was it that made him stand out to them?
Well, I think you've been listening to an interesting interview that I did many years ago with Mike Sheehan to call in the newsreader. One of the most celebrated, you know, with great respect, one of the most celebrated people in football. The on-field coach of the Essendon Football Club of 300 games, revered in the game. It was very interesting. One of the discussions I had with Trevor Barker, you know, in losing Trevor, was the profile and type of coach that the club was potentially going to look for. And it was a new generation coach. I looked long and hard, you know, not for an old recycle, you know, I won't say recycle, but an older coach, was to look for somebody young to bring this team, because at this stage the team had matured. And there was an expectation that the senior players would take on an increased level of responsibility, as the Carlton players did in the late 90s with Parkin. And I can give you plenty of other examples, you know, with the Brisbane Lions under that. There was a level of maturity in our club. People criticise our club for lack of leadership. 17 of those people have gone on, you know, whether it be young Lappin, whether it be Harvey, et cetera, to coach and stand up in senior football positions. So, you know, there was not a question of this club leading having, you know, leadership problems. Hall went on to captain the Swans to a premiership. Darryl Wakeland went on to be the bloody vice-captain of Port Adelaide to win a premiership. So the club, which I will argue long and hard for, had a dutiful rank of senior people that knew what they were doing, that could do things. What the club needed was a Trevor Barker type of coach, and Watson fitted that bill. Quiet. And, you know, was directive, been able to work with young people and senior players as well. And he did it. What happened was that there was a sort of expectation. And, you know, we looked halfway through that first season. I mean, again, Aaron, if you want to call him a newsreader, call him a newsreader, but you've just been disrespectful. You know, we were second on the ladder halfway through the season. Then there was just a gap in that, and I'm not going to go there, but, you know, Tim blames himself of not being able to get the message through to his other coaching staff. We lacked an assistant coach that we had previously signed up when we're going to sign up when Tim had arrived. So there's a whole lot of issues behind it.
Andrew, I guess last one from me, a little bit of a two-parter, I guess, but what do you see, having been in the seat, what do you see makes a good president of a football club? We've seen a lot of different personalities come through different footy clubs, from your John Elliott, Eddie Maguire, Jeff Kennett. Yeah, at our footy club, we've had some quieter guys since Rod Butters, Greg Westaway, Peter Summers, and now Andrew Bassett. What makes a good president? And I guess, lastly, what's your relationship as a fan now with the football club? I mean, are you there watching every week? How do you feel about the footy club these days?
Well, let's answer that first. I feel good. I'm welcome, very welcome in the football club. I knew Bassett in a prior life. I know the chief executive well from his days back with the Players Association. I am involved. I am chairman of Community Concussion Australia, so I have an involvement with the health and welfare of AFL footballers. particularly, we all have knowledge of one footballer that suffered from CTE at our club. So in that sense, I have a good relationship. I'm a life member of the club. I tend to, get to events that are important. I get regularly. I'm still, great friends with the players. I get to games. Typically at Etihad, I get invited to games by others. I have lots of other things in my life. I do a lot of sailing still, competitive sailing. So, I'm active, but I love the club and I still go there and give them advice and catch up with particularly past players. I go regularly with football with Gary Collin, et cetera, like that. So, lifelong friends I have from the St Kilda Footy Club. What's the profile required? I think the profile's changed a little bit. It did require, back in my years, when I look at the great personalities, they're not saying they're not great personalities now, but clubs were very much president-led in many ways. The chief executives, tended to sit behind the scenes a little bit. And, the egos and the great sort of spruikers in the market and entrepreneurs and those like Elliot, McGuire, I was thinking of all the mates I had in all the interstate clubs, were all the upfront people presenting for and on behalf of the club. Now it's very much more controlled by CEO. The CEO role has been lifted a few notches. They're certainly, their pay grade has been, and they are a critical and important part of the club now. In a sense of public, the public, in a public sense, chief executives have a more exacting and higher profile role than they ever did back in the days, in the 90s when I was president.
It was an incredible period at the club from 93 to 2000. There were a number of significant challenges and significant decisions, and you always led the club through that with passion, and we appreciate you giving us some time. You've got a major role and a major chapter in the club's history, and we appreciate all you did.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, mate.